Hello, and you're very welcome to episode 9 of The Fifth Court, a podcast on legal affairs presented by myself, Peter Leonard, barrister.
And myself, Mark Tottenham, barrister and editor of Decisis.ie.
Mark, we got a spectacular reaction to last week's interview with Supreme Court Judge Gerard Hogan, who discussed the centenary trial of Erskine Childers.
Such an extraordinary story.
You're a legal historian, so you love that. I loved it myself. It was really, really good.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, today we are delighted to be joined by the chairperson of the Bar Council, Senior Counsel Sarah Phelan, who is almost 2 months into her 2-year term of office, and we're going to talk to her about her aims and objectives. I know she's loads of those. Where the bar currently is and what challenges faces the country's barristers. So that's going to be a fascinating interview. But first, we're going to discuss three cases which you have identified from the Decisis website. Today, we're going to start with a very important Supreme Court decision on the role of the Irish language in drafting domestic legislation, including statutory instruments. And this is a case called Glanmore Cave Chorinta versus the Minister for Housing. And it's a decision of who else but
Mr. Justice Hogan, friend of the show.
Friend of the show. And it concerned whether the failure to provide Irish translation of statutory instruments could prejudice challengers to a compulsory purchase order of Gaeltacht lands.
Exactly. Well, the compulsory purchase order in this case was by Irish Water, and it concerned a pier in the Connemara Gaeltacht. And as happens very often with these matters, it was going to go to a public oral hearing. And the issue that arose here was that the legislation underpinning the compulsory purchase order, or some of the relevant legislation, hadn't yet been translated into Irish. And not only had the primary legislation not been translated, but some of the statutory instruments underpinning the legislation hadn't been translated either. Now, in Bunreacht na hÉireann, there is a provision that once legislation is passed in either Irish or English, that then an official translation needs to be made into the other first national language. And in the High Court, it was found that a delay of 17 months in providing an official translation was excessive. And this was appealed by the Minister for Housing. And in the Supreme Court, Mr. Justice Hogan, this is a unanimous decision, upheld that finding that it was an unlawful delay. He also pointed out that there was a 10-year delay in translation. There's something like 450 pieces of primary legislation that haven't yet been translated into Irish. Now, there's a body in Leinster House called Ranóg na hÉisteachán, I think it's called, whose job it is to translate these matters. But obviously, they're not working.
Maybe they don't have enough people employed. So, any linguists out there in the national language, so there could be an opportunity available for
you. Exactly. But it's just worth saying he did, however, say it wasn't necessary for the statutory instruments to be translated into Irish.
Yeah, explain that. That's quite significant.
So acts of primary legislation, statutory instruments.
What about European directives, etc.?
Exactly. Some statutory instruments have the power to amend primary legislation under the European Communities Act. And he said, in order to comply with the Constitution, it was necessary for those specific statutory instruments to be translated.
So if it's primary legislation, it must be Os Gaeilge.
Exactly.
Yeah, in order to comply with the constitutional requirement. Yeah. Okay, very good. Next to an interesting decision in the area of receivership law from Ms. Justice Whelan in the Court of Appeal. This is the case of Ken Fennell, versus Gilroy. And the case concerned Ben Gilroy, who is a well-known activist, and who, as a third party, was challenging a receiver's right to exercise rights over a property where the mortgagor or borrower had been in default. This case goes back to 2011, in which a judgment in the sum of over €2 million had been entered against the mortgagor.
Exactly. Yeah. So the issue that arose here was that there was a mortgage, there was a default, a receiver was appointed, which is one of the options that's available to the bank. Generally, the question is, do they appoint a receiver or do they go into possession? And Mr. Gilroy, who was not the mortgagor, he wasn't the borrower in the case, but he tried to claim that he had a right of action by virtue of a contract that he had with the original mortgagor, and he was thrown out in the High Court, and that was upheld in the Court of Appeal. They basically said, it's not open to you to be challenging the right of a receiver if you don't have a direct cause of action yourself. It's the courts try to discourage third-party actions.
Yes, absolutely. Now to my favourite favourite case of the night, Mark. And this is a fascinating case, and it involves your favourite topic, a cattle crush. You explained brilliantly what happens in the cattle crush a couple of weeks ago. And this is the case of McDermott versus Chagask. And it's a decision of Mr. Justice O'Moore, and it involved... I suppose that the facts are very interesting in this case. It concerned a bovine embryologist who had been engaged by a farmer to carry out pregnancy tests on his cattle. And I suppose that's why they were in the cattle crush in the first place.
In fact, he was engaged by Chagask.
Chagask. Okay, very good. Sorry, I beg your pardon. And this obviously involved restraining cattle in order to do tests and stuff like that. I'm going to let you take it over from here.
Exactly. So as I explained before, for people like yourself who didn't grow up in the mud of the land...
plenty of time in the land, I'll have you know. But anyway,
in order to carry out tests on a bullock or a cow, you need to put them into a cattle crush. And in this case, in order to carry out the pregnancy test, which basically required a camera to be inserted where cameras needed to be inserted, a neck restraint was put on the cattle. Now, it was open to the embryologist to also put a rear restraint on the cattle, but that would slow down his work. And as was pointed out by the court, he was being paid by the animal, so he was trying to test as many cattle as possible. Once in one instance, once the neck restraint was removed, somehow the cow actually fell on top of him, and so he suffered personal injuries. And obviously, he sued Chagas, claiming that they had some kind of unsafe system. And unfortunately for him,
and was the neck brace not sufficient? I'm sure that was the argument they advanced.
Well, I think the problem was that the neck brace didn't stop the animal moving backwards. Effectively,
okay.
That once the animal was released, somehow the animal fell over and caused injury. Whereas if the rear restraint, and this was admitted by the plaintiff, if the rear restraint had been in place, he wouldn't have suffered the injury.
So Mr. Justice O'Moore said you should have put the rear restraint in place,
exactly,
and therefore the defendant was not liable.
Indeed.
Okay, so we're going to come back very shortly with the chairperson of the Bar Council of Ireland, Sarah Phelan, Senior Counsel.
Silence in the Fifth Court.
Okay, it is my great pleasure to welcome to the studio Sarah Phelan, Senior Counsel, who's the chairperson of the Bar Council. Sarah, you're very good for coming in to us.
Thank you, Peter.
And even though you're the doyen of Inns Quay, I believe you've dashed all the way from Kilkenny.
Well, I live in Kilkenny, so that's where I'm based with my husband and my son. And I used to, before COVID, travel up and down on the train every day. But since COVID and since taking over as chair, there are some evening meetings or afternoon meetings. So I've treated myself to the luxury of actually renting a place in Dublin.
Yes, well, so, that's probably necessary, isn't it? And you're 2 months in. How's it been so far? Before we get into the nitty gritty, how are you enjoying it so far?
I love it. Really love it. I'm actually surprising myself as to how much I'm enjoying it.
Great.
Even the more difficult bits, I'm still enjoying them. So yeah, it's great. Really, 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 it's wonderful.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, well, let's go back. You mentioned you're currently living in Kilkenny, mm-hmm. and I believe you're a Kilkenny woman, true and true.
I am. My mother and father are both Kilkenny people, they're now deceased, but were both Kilkenny people. I grew up in Waterford, actually, and then went to boarding school and then came to Dublin. But since 2001, I've lived back in Kilkenny full time.
Okay. And the law didn't grab you initially. You were initially a scientist, I believe.
I was.
Sarah, is that right?
Well, in school, I was probably my best subjects were maths, chemistry and physics. So they were, I suppose, pushing me in a particular direction. And I didn't want to do medicine and I didn't want to be a dentist. They were the two kind of sciencey careers that were looking at me. And my mother suggested that I do pharmacy. So,
yes.
Like a good...
good, sensible gig.
Obedient 17-year-old, I put down pharmacy as number one on the CAO, and I got pharmacy. So I didn't really give it any serious thought. My mother always said it was a good job for a woman, and it's only now, looking back, that I understood what she meant in terms of career flexibility and time flexibility if you were having a family or you'd other commitments. But, you know, at 17, that was not on my radar at all. So I went to Trinity. I was 18 in the August, so I was just gone 18 when I started in Trinity. And I really enjoyed the course.
Yes.
It was 4 years, and I mean, I loved it. The subject material was really interesting, and I was a good old crammer back in the day. So 6 weeks before the exams, the head went down. Yeah. The subjects got studied.
Very valuable in the law. Let's be honest about it, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I was 2 weeks into working as a pharmacist and I realised it wasn't for me. Okay. Now, that was in community pharmacy back in the day. That was really where one went if one didn't go into industry. Hospital pharmacy has come an awfully long way in the last 25 years or so. So even more, actually. So I think if I were doing pharmacy now, I might have gone into hospital pharmacy and I might never have become a barrister.
Yes.
But back in the day, it wasn't really an option for me.
So 2 weeks in, the light bulb moment, and you said, I think I'm going to do something else. But was it law at that stage or was it, you know,
Completely
different?
I had to do a license year to become a member of the Pharmaceutical Society. So I did that year and then I said to my boss, OK, I will work for so long as it takes you to get my replacement. But if I get a job in the meantime, I'm going. But I mean, I applied to 40 odd pharmaceutical companies back in the day and not one of them had jobs going. So this was back in the late 1980s. Ireland wasn't a successful economic place as it became in the noughties. So it took me a year to get a job in industry. And then I moved to Leo Laboratories in Dublin. And it was when I was in Leo Labs that I decided I was going to do King's Inns.
Yes.
But obviously not having a law degree, I had to go in and do the diploma, first of all, 2 year diploma. And even then, I didn't really want to be a barrister. I was doing that because I thought it would be good for me career-wise, but I didn't know what the career was going to look like.
Of course, of course. But then when you got into it, were you into debating or any of that sort of stuff in the background?
I debated a tiny bit in school, Oscuelga, actually. But no, I wasn't particularly interested.
So there you go. To all the folks out there, you don't have to be a debater to be a very successful barrister, as you are, Sarah. Never mind your new gig as chairperson of the Bar Council.
Yeah, no, I wasn't interested in debating, wasn't interested in public speaking, wasn't interested in anything like that. But I did the diploma. Really interesting. I mean, we had William Binchy lecturing us in torts. We had Eamon Leahy lecturing us in criminal law. I mean, really, really good lecturers. And it just grabbed me. And then I did the degree, and it was when I was in the first year in the degree, I started doing moot competitions.
Okay.
And that's what
So you got into it then at that stage. Okay, very
then
good.
Then I decided I wanted to be a barrister.
So when were you called? What year?
I was called in 96.
96, okay. And you had to devil.
So I deviled.
Who did you devil with?
Well, I suppose I didn't make up my mind to come down that year, come down to the law library, until very late in the day. I thought I might stay working for another couple of years and earn a bit of dosh, which, as you know, is very important in the early years. But in the meantime, I'd actually gotten married. So I had a supportive spouse who still
Always
is
important.
A supportive spouse. but it was important.
Always important. Very good career move.
So then Tom said to me, you know, if you're going to go down, you may as well go down with all your compatriots in the inns because it's easier that you're all poor together or not earning a wage or earning an income together. So that's what I did. I came down in 96 and late in the day started looking for a master. And it wasn't as competitive as it is now in terms of people trying to line up masters in the areas that they actually have an interest in. Mine was a lot more organic than that. So I had been previously friendly with Vincent Tinahan. He was deviling with Una McCran the year before me. And Vincent suggested Una and I met Una and she said, yes, you can be my devil. I'll be your master. And that's how it worked out. And Una was
a leading
fantastic
senior counsel in the area of PI.
Yeah.
I presume in other areas as well, but that's how I know her.
And Medneg.
So, and Medneg, of course.
Yeah, so I mean, Una was a fantastic master. She had a very broad junior practice at that stage. Lots of different areas. And I was on my feet doing motions and doing whatever a devil does.
Got up and running.
And up and running.
And when I first met you, it was down in the Southeastern Circuit. So obviously, after your stint in Dublin, Kilkenny was calling again, was it?
Yeah, well, somebody who features a little in my career progression, Marguerite Bulger, Judge of the High Court now.
Yes, recently appointed.
Yes, but Marguerite was actually, still is, very, very good friends with my middle sister, and Marguerite's a Kilkenny woman. So it was Marguerite actually put it into my head, you know, something going on circuit would be a good thing. And I had a chat with Una and she agreed. And then Una's husband, Noel McMahon, sat opposite Aidan Walsh in the Irish Bay. You know, these things are very organic, Peter. So Noel had a chat with Aidan for me and Aidan suggested Tom Tien as my master on circuit. So I spoke to Tom Tien, now retired judge. And then I went down in circuit. And to be honest, I didn't look back.
Oh, wow. Well, you're never going to look back with Tom Tien, in fairness. Father of the Leinster Bar, as
Absolutely,
we all know.
Yeah, yeah.
An all-round good guy.
Yeah.
So wonderful. Now, you were family law? Is that what? Am I right to associate you with family law? Maybe that's a little unfair.
No, you are right. But again, went down on circuit, did everything to begin with. Tom didn't do any or very, very little family law. But I did PI, I did crime, I did licensing, I did landlord and tenant. I mean, on circuit, you kind of do everything to begin with. You don't, it chooses you, you don't choose it. But I was lucky because, so I went down on circuit in 97. The Family Law Divorce Act had just commenced in early 97, and there was an opening, there was a floodgates of family law applications. And I suppose it was a question of being in the right place at the right time. And I was interested in family law.
Mm. And there was certainly a perception, certainly early on in the circuit, that family law was very much sort of dominated by women. I mean, was that sort of opportunity in the sense that there were more women coming into the bar at the time that family law developed, or do you think it was just an area that men sort of steered away from, or is there any kind of logic that you can put to it?
I don't think I can put any logic to it, Mark. I mean, it developed for me organically. I was there. I was interested. There were some male colleagues on circuit doing family law. When I came down on circuit, there weren't that many females ahead of me. There weren't that many women. So Marguerite was obviously there before she came back to Dublin and established her employment law practice. We had Sally O'Kelly, Mary Laverty was there, Onya Swift was there, but there weren't that many women. So I think I just fell into a niche, to be honest. It was luck, it was timing.
And we had Keith Walsh on a few weeks ago, but I mean
that's right. I listened to that podcast.
And I mean, as I said to him, I mean it's an area that certainly, to the extent that I've gone into it, it can be quite dispiriting if you're not used to it. There are a lot of you can very easily come out of court and think there are no winners in this. I mean, did you find it got you down at times, or is it an area you were able to work with?
No, it never got me down. I think I was lucky. So I was 30 when I came into the library. So I had that bit of life experience sure. behind me. And I just learned very quickly to develop a Teflon skin. So, you know, you go into court, you do the best for your client. But when you come out, you have to leave it behind.
Sure.
And I was actually really good at doing that.
Yeah.
But I think that was from a promise I made to myself when I actually came into the library, that I was never going to look at anybody else and look at how their practice developed. I was just going to deal with my practice. And one of the other promises I made to myself was I was never going to worry about stuff I had no control over.
Sure.
And to be honest, I think they were two very good life skills that I developed, which enabled me in many respects to develop a career in family law, because I did my best, but I didn't take home my clients' issues. Because if you did, you weren't going to be able to advise them properly. And I learned that very quickly.
And it would be very easy to do that in family law, wouldn't it? Because there are just so many issues involved.
It is very easy to do it. But I think if you do it and if you identify with your client, then you're not doing the best for your client.
Sure.
Okay, and let's talk about the Bar Council, Sarah, mm-hmm. because as you established a wonderful practice, which you still have and you are working busily at, as well as doing this job on top of that. How did you get involved in the Bar Council?
Well, to be honest, Peter, I mean, when I went down on circuit, I rarely came to Dublin. So between 1997 and 2013, when I took Silk, I wasn't a regular attender at the Law Library. But for personal reasons, I suppose, I had a son in 2006. And for the first number of years after that, I was interested in getting him established and into school. Then I took Silk in 2013. He was in, I think, first year of first class at that stage. And then as I began to gradually reacquaint myself with Dublin, I began to get involved in more Law Library or Bar Council issues. So I think the first thing I did was I became a tutor on the Advanced Advocacy course. And then thereafter, I became involved in the Law and Women Mentoring Committee. And I suppose gradually I was looking for things outside my professional life to keep me interested. Previous to that, I'd been chairperson of the Board of Management in my son's school in Kilkenny.
Yes.
And I liked the idea. I mean, I've always liked the idea of volunteering. So whether it's inside the law or outside the law, I also did some, actually took over from Marguerite again, the Kilkenny Citizens Information Centre. I did legal information evenings there before I had Hugo. And then, as I say, afterwards, I was looking for other areas. So
okay.
I digressed into...
And as some people mightn't realise, but in order to get onto the Bar Council, you have to be elected. And
you
it's
do.
A tough election. I mean, there's, you know, that it's a tough electorate, I have to say, you know, and trying to convince enough people to vote for you because you're going up against colleagues. There's a lot of people going for it. So you did very well to get elected.
Well, I tend to do things and then ask how to do them afterwards. So somebody suggested I put my name forward for the Bar Council and I said, fine, I will. And then I set about wondering how I was going to achieve the election. And I've done that in other areas too. I mean, I've never really thought too much. I've gone ahead and done something.
Just give it a lash.
Give it a lash. I'm not afraid of failure. For me, I think it's worse to let fear hold you back. So I'd rather do something and not achieve it rather than let the fear hold me back and not actually do it.
And did you have particular issues when you first ran for the Bar Council that you were looking to put forward, or was it just an interest in kind of bar politics?
Well, I think nobody would accuse me, I think, Mark, of being interested in bar politics up until I got on to the council. And I really didn't know what to expect. And it was an eye-opener. I mean, an absolute eye-opener in terms of the amount of voluntary work that is done behind the scenes. There are, you know, 13, I think, committees and any number of people involved in those committees, both elected members and non-elected members. And I just had no concept of the amount of time and effort that people gave willingly to the Bar Council. And it was when I got onto the committees that I actually saw the work and became more and more interested.
And which committees were you on in the first instance?
So in the first instance, I chaired the Arbitration ADR Committee. Now, that kind of fitted into my mediation. I did a lot of mediation. I'm very involved in mediation. And more laterally, some arbitration as well. So that kind of floated my boat. Education and training floated my boat. And the PPC floated my boat.
That's the Professional Practices Committee.
Professional Practices Committee, yes. And I suppose having come from a regulated profession in pharmacy, that whole background that really, really interested me. And I love the concept of legal ethics and where that leads us and what is permissible and not. So that really floated my boat. Yep.
Okay. And not only did you get elected to the Bar Council, but in September this year, you were made chairperson and you had to be elected again by the members of the Bar Council. Another wonderful achievement, Sarah.
Well, thank you, Peter. I suppose looking back, it is. At the time, I did 2 years on the Bar Council, 19 to 21. They were a very interesting but difficult 2 years because of COVID. And then I got re-elected in 21. And I suppose it was when I was being re-elected in 2021 that sowed the seed then in terms of maybe I will try for chair in 2022.
And it's all out politics, isn't it? I mean, you have to convince your colleagues that you're the one.
Yes, that was...
You know, it doesn't automatically happen.
No, and that was a really interesting...
I can imagine it was.
...experience.
Can we put that on mic?
Very interesting experience in terms of, you know, just alliances and...
Yes, of course.
And all of that. And I was lucky.
And is it to decide to go for chair again? Were there sort of areas that you wanted to push, or when you talk about alliances, are there? If those of us outside the Bar Council, we wouldn't know what these alliances are. But are there people who are looking to prioritise one area rather than others?
No, I think the alliances were more in terms of getting oneself elected, Mark. Thereafter, obviously, the council is very cohesive in terms of working for the betterment of the members and the profession. But I do, I did think, you know, Maura, my predecessor, she showed great leadership during COVID. And her focus was in terms of moving us out of COVID and dealing with all the issues that COVID brought to us. And there were a number of them. And then obviously she commissioned, well, the Bar Council, but through her leadership, commissioned the EY report into the profession. So that then gave me a significant segue into what I thought I might achieve during my term. Yeah. And the term is only 1 year, but there's a tradition that the chair goes forward unopposed for a second year. So practically it's hopefully a two-year term. Mm. And as you say, Peter, I'm just in. I'm in it a wet week
just
at this
in.
Stage.
Yeah, just in and settling in, you know, but you have loads of ambitions. Will you just set those out for us, Sarah, just at this stage? Before we get in again, we'll ask you about some of those.
Yeah.
But just generally, what would you like to achieve over those 2 years?
So I think if I were to sum up in one word, what I would like to achieve for the profession in the next 2 years, it's relevance. So I want us as a profession and as an independent referral bar to be as relevant to the society that we serve now and in the future as we have been in the past. And obviously our Irish society has changed significantly in the last 20 years or so, and how that society is made up.
Okay.
We have, I mean, we've a greater population, and we have a more inclusive population now than certainly we had when I started as a barrister back in 96.
Okay, the word relevance is very interesting. Do you think there's a possibility that we might become less relevant?
Well, I think if we don't move with the changing times, we are going to become less relevant.
Okay.
And therefore, it's to look at how we can change with society, keep up with society, and keep up with technological developments and developments in other areas, that we can then move on and people still need us. Because if we don't change, we are going to get left behind.
Okay, okay, that's very interesting. And as you said, under your predecessor, Maura McNally, who was brilliant, and you're the third woman chairperson, aren't you? Bella Carroll going way back,
way back.
Then Maura, and obviously now yourself. But she commissioned the EY report, and that told us a lot, didn't it, about the profession. What did the Bar Council pick up from that?
Oh, the Bar Council picked up a lot. I mean, the EY report made 51 recommendations, and of those, 46 have either been implemented or are in the process of being implemented. And then it made 5 recommendations in terms of a business model, which EY termed a MEHL. And there was a working group assembled to look at the concept of the MEHL. I was on that working group. And we felt that the concept of a MEHL wasn't really going to put the bar where we needed to be.
And can you just outline for our listeners, what did they mean when they talked about it, MEHL? I mean, obviously, we know the tradition of people all working together in the fields and helping their neighbours and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But in bar council in barrister terms, what are we talking about?
Well, what they looked at, or what they thought, was that there would be a grouping of barristers, not chambers, but a loose grouping of barristers of senior barristers and junior barristers, very junior and very senior, and everybody in between, who might have a subject matter in common, or who might have other issues in common, and that they would work together, they would market themselves, and that they might share, that there might be some administrative task sharing as well. But we looked at it and felt that at the moment we have devil families, and that there are other, perhaps, groupings that we felt the MEHL wasn't going to cure one of the ailments it needed to cure, and that was inclusivity and diversity. So we felt that the concept of the MEHL wasn't going to work, but we did commit ourselves to looking at our business model, and that is what we are in the process of doing at the moment.
Sure.
So we're in the very early stages of that, but that is one of my number one priorities, if one can have more than one number one priorities. But anyway, it's to look at that business model, to see how we can develop, to make sure that we're attracting the brightest and the best into the library. We are retaining the brightest and the best.
That's the big issue, isn't it?
I mean,
the brightest and the best often leave the law library for bizarre reasons. It can be hard to understand why somebody who is very talented is not making it. And then others make it as well, who are also very talented, let us add. But how do we retain people? It is a difficult game for so many people, isn't it?
It's a very difficult game, Peter. And there's no doubt about that. But we're all self-employed. So I think we have to start at that basis. And being self-employed in any profession is a difficult business.
Sure.
You don't walk into a salary. And I suppose that's the first issue we have, where you have the large firms now in Dublin offering a significant salary at traineeship level.
Yeah.
And I've heard figures of 45,000, 50,000, 55,000 quoted.
But a lot of people could be in the law library for 5-6 years before they're earning that kind of money.
Or longer, Mark.
And lots
or
longer. As well, yes.
So, first of all, we have to attract those who would be attracted elsewhere, but who might have an inclination to be good barristers. We need to attract them in. So we need to look at how we're going to do that. And then you're right, Peter, we need to look at the retention. Now, I have to say, a lot of people leave the library for very good reason and move on to stellar careers elsewhere.
Sure.
And we've just started an alumni association, and we had an inaugural event a number of weeks ago that was really successful. And various former members of the library came back in to speak about how their careers have developed and progressed since they left the library. And so people come in and they may not stay for a variety of reasons, but we want to make sure that those who want to stay can stay.
Yes.
And that's a significant issue that we have to grapple with. Sure. And, you know, we don't all have the answers. But until we grapple with the issues, we're not going to come up with the answers.
Well, you can't give somebody a job, Sarah. I mean, that's the point. I mean, you can try and assist people and maybe create panels, or there can be different ways of maybe doing things, improving things. But at the end of the day, as you say, you're self-employed and there's a risk, unfortunately.
There is.
And the ball doesn't always bounce fairly. Generally, you know, it's a meritocracy. We would agree with that. But, you know, it is difficult. So there's only so much you can do.
There's only so much we can do, Peter, but I think we can do more than we have historically done.
Okay, good.
Well, I mean, one of the obvious challenges, I suppose, for a lot of people is when they become parents, and obviously it's a particular issue for women, but not just for women. Has the Bar Council ever looked at opening a creche or doing something to make it more address the balance? Because it's one thing to go part-time if you're in a job, but it's very difficult to go part-time as a barrister, because sometimes you need to work more than 40 hours a week and sometimes more than twice 40 hours a week.
So back in 2015... A lady involved, Maura Butler, involved with the Irish Women's Law Association, approached David Barnevill, now president of the High Court, but when he was chair of the bar, to look at developing a mentoring system for women in the library. And in around the same time, there was a survey done, and the women's of all members, and the women's working group was born out of that survey. And they at that time, so this was back in 2016, perhaps, they looked at having a creche or starting up a creche at that stage, and the work was done, I suppose, in terms of was it feasible, feasibility study. And it was felt that a creche wasn't an option for the Law Library because, first of all, you have statutory regulation in terms of the numbers of staff you have for very young babies. And also then a lot of women didn't want to use the creche 5 days a week. So it was looked at, and unfortunately it was decided, Mark, it just wasn't a runner. And we've had recent queries as well.
Can I just come in there? But a more recent intervention by the Bar Council, if we're to believe what we read in the papers, Sarah, is an initiative to try and encourage work for female barristers. And, you know, again, if we believe what we read in the paper, some of the lads aren't happy. They're not happy about this, Sarah. Is there? What do you say about that?
I thought that might come up, Peter. So, well, first of all, I think the first thing we need to be careful of is I wouldn't believe everything I read in the paper.
Okay, fair enough.
And
but you would believe everything you hear in a podcast.
Absolutely. Particularly when it's the chair of the Bar Council. So, yes, we have an equitable briefing policy. It is to be launched next year in 2023. It's been a long time in the development, and we looked at other jurisdictions who've had developed and had an equitable briefing policy where it's been successful. So two of those jurisdictions are New Zealand and Australia. And the idea of the equitable briefing policy is not to promote women over men. Okay, I think that's a misconception. And first of all, when a solicitor is choosing a barrister, and this may apply more to the solicitors in the large firms and perhaps who have commercial clients, but that obviously they need a barrister of a particular seniority or not, depending on the case. They need a barrister, obviously, with a particular area of expertise. And then the idea is that when they have those boxes ticked, seniority and expertise, that they would make sure when they're giving a list of barristers to a client, for that client to choose, that they would make sure they have women on that list as well as men. So really all the equitable briefing policy is doing is asking solicitors to look outside maybe their normal briefing panel.
Okay. Yes.
And to make
sure
women...
a form of positive action, though, just to sort of to make it more inclusive. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's to make it more inclusive in terms of having women on the panel. But it's the client on those commercial levels who would have a say in terms of who the barrister is. So it's still for the client, if the client is faced with three men and three women on a panel, it's still for the client to say who they want.
Yes, of course. We're not, and you can't interfere with that, of course.
No, yeah. And we're not asking that solicitors would ask the client to prefer a woman over a man at that level, but it's simply having women's names included in the mix.
And be more open-minded, I suppose.
Absolutely.
That's it. Can I just, I notice we're getting signals through the window, Mark. We're galloping along here. This is where we're using up loads of time. We probably should talk about the you know, COVID, post-COVID, mm-hmm. Online court hearings, et cetera, et cetera. You mentioned Mr. Justice David Barnevelle. He took over from Ms. Justice Mary Irvine as President of the High Court. Mm-hmm. And he's brought about a bit of a change. He wants more in action, more court action, maybe than had previously been the case. How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, we're welcoming it with open arms. And I suppose President Barnevelle has taken over at a time where the whole society has opened back up again. And therefore his initiative in terms of making as many hearings in person as possible has been really welcomed by us. But I do think we as a profession also need to take that initiative, because sometimes it's very easy to do a hearing online from the comfort of one's office or one's home.
Yes.
Or the floor of the law library. And instead, we need to, I think, we need to shake ourselves up a bit, and we need to make sure we're getting back into court.
Yeah.
Where there are, so where we have an option of an in-person or a hybrid hearing, and a lot of the applications at the moment can be one way or the other, we need to make sure that we are back in court insofar as we can humanly possibly be. I mean, I do accept some members may have caring responsibilities and it's easier for them to do something from the comfort of their home office.
And I mean, there's obviously, we had Gerard Grok and Stephen Dowling recently, and both of them thought that that online hearings were a manna from heaven, because at last you were able to do a hearing while you were at your desk. It didn't mean you have to take half a day out. And I must say, from looking from the other side, I mean, certainly as a junior barrister, if you've got a motion in a long motion list, you can take an entire day waiting for it to come on for hearing. Whereas at least if you're in your office, you can work, you can do other things, you can keep an eye on what's going on, and you can be ready for the hearing. I mean, it's certainly not a one-way street, is it? I mean, a lot of people really like the online hearings.
It's not, Mark, but I think my concern is that the efficiency that's achieved with online hearings means that the other advantages to being in court are lost. So if I'm a junior barrister and I'm doing an online hearing, then I don't have the chance for another solicitor or somebody else to see me on my feet. Because let's face it, if you're just looking, if you've somebody online, a solicitor online, looking at a junior colleague doing a motion online, first of all, that solicitor isn't concentrating because they're probably doing some paperwork or whatever, waiting for their case to come up. And I do think being back in person gives junior colleagues a much better opportunity to promote their skills in person, and for somebody else to notice those skills far more so than you would online. And I think then as well, the other issue is that if you have people in court, you're, because you can't be making phone calls in court, you're more likely than not to be listening to what's going on in court. Whereas if you're online waiting for your own motion to come on, chances are you're doing emails or you're doing something else. And I think then the learning opportunity for being in court is actually lost. When you're online, you don't see people making mistakes even. You don't see people doing things that you think, oh, actually, I could have done that a better way or a different way. And I think those learning opportunities are lost.
But you can't run a court list entirely on the educational benefits for junior barristers. I mean, it's obvious, you know, the delays involved in I mean, hanging around a court, for want of a better term. I mean, you very often see 20, 30 barristers sitting in court just waiting for their short motions to come on.
It's a great way to catch up and gossip, though, isn't it, Sarah? You know, it's not all bad.
No, and also I think this is a case of, and I've used this phrase in giving speeches before, the whole is definitely more than the sum of its parts.
Yes, absolutely. Mm.
So I think we have more to lose by being online than we have to gain. I think we've much more to gain by being in court, because there are other efficiencies gained when you're in court. I might see a colleague that I know I have another case with, and I might talk about that case with that colleague and maybe narrow the issues or set up a meeting or something else. And I'm not going to do that if I'm online.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, can I bring you on just because we are galloping through time, Sarah? This has been really fascinating. And we have our little questions at the end, which we have to get to as well. Beforehand, you are the representative now for the barrister's body, dealing with the state, for example, dealing with the government, dealing with the Minister for Justice. Tell me about that. How do you feel about doing all that sort of stuff?
Well, I think that's really important to have that dialogue with government and with the Minister for Justice and the Department of Expenditure and Public Reform, which is where we need to focus our efforts at the moment, particularly with the area of criminal legal aid.
Yes.
And we've had ongoing dealings with the Department of Justice. And back in 2018, the Department of Justice actually agreed and also the DPP agreed that various efficiencies that barristers had promulgated meant that the criminal legal aid fees should be restored, the fees that had been cut during the recession, and they weren't actually FEMPI cuts, but those cuts were made during the FEMPI cuts, and the Department of Justice and the DPP felt that our fees should be restored, and then it went over to the Department of Expenditure and Public Reform, and that is where matters lie, okay, Peter, at the moment.
Well, we had Catherine McGillicuddy in here, and yes, I was asking her, what's the mood like up there in the Phoenix Park? Is there a febrile atmosphere? Sarah, are you going to be leading the charge? Should we dust off our placards as we speak?
Well, I'd love to be able to look into the crystal ball, Peter, and tell you what's going to happen. But certainly,
what about a strike? I mean, this is what people are mentioning. Our colleagues across the water in Britain did that.
They did in Britain, and it was a very different setup over there.
Okay, very good.
So I'm not going to promise anything on that score. We'll just have to wait and see.
So quiet diplomacy for the moment.
I think quiet diplomacy will get us a long way.
Okay. Mark, do you want to ask
the final key question?
We have so many more questions to ask, but I think we're kind of 35, 40 minutes. So we have to wrap it up at this stage.
It's a recommendation to the legal profession from the chairperson of the Bar Council in terms of either a book or a film, or possibly both.
Great.
What do you have to say for us?
Well, I think my film, I had two films, but one of them was actually recommended by a previous interviewee, and that was To Kill a Mockingbird. But anyway, my other recommendation, and I think this comes from the fact that we can never be a juror, so 12 Angry Men.
Of course.
And I think 12 Angry Men, 1957, it's an absolutely classic
Henry
film.
Fonda.
Yes. And I've watched it, I don't know how many times.
Yes.
And I just think the interplay between the jurors and the psychological interventions, and it's just fascinating, because obviously I'd love to be a fly on a jury room wall, but I'll never get that chance.
No, absolutely. And what about your book?
Well, those who know me will know that I'm an absolute fan of Philippe Sands.
Of course.
And so I have two of his books to recommend. First of all, East West Street, and the whole, it really explains really, really well the concept and how it came about of crimes against humanity and the concept of genocide and how they came to be formed and thought about in the context of the Nuremberg trials back in the 40s. And I just found that book on so many levels to be absolutely fascinating. And then his more recent book, The Lost Colony, about the Chagos Islands and how they were taken from Mauritius by the British government at the time. And that's a fascinating introduction to the International Court of Justice.
Okay.
And they're still looking for compensation, is that right?
They are, but I think more recently, in the last number of weeks, the British government has indicated a willingness to actually engage, which is a significant step forward.
Okay, wow. Well, they're definitely two wonderful new titles to add to our list, Mark. Yeah. You can put that up on your website. Sarah, can I just thank you? First of all, you're only 2 months into the gig. Can I wish you every success over the next 2 years? And it will
thank
be
you,
2 years. It will be 2 years. You're a wonderful representative for us all the barristers down in the four courts and beyond throughout the country. And can I thank you most sincerely for coming in and being a guest on the Fifth Court?
You're more than welcome. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Peter.
The Fifth Court will adjourn until next week.
So that's all from this edition of The Fifth Court. We hope you have enjoyed it. Can we say a huge thank you to our guest, Chairperson of the Bar Council, Sarah Phelan, Senior Counsel, who talked to us all about her plans for the Bar Council over the next 2 years. It's going to be a busy time for her, Mark.
Absolutely, yeah. A really interesting time.
Yeah, and she's all set and has great intentions. So let's watch this space. I would also like to say a big thank you to our producer, Cunnel O'Moroyne, and to the Dublin South Podcast Studios for recording this show and doing such a wonderful job. If you have any comments or any legal stories you would like us to raise, you can contact us via our website or on LinkedIn. And as always, we're asking you to share the podcast.
Any friends, colleagues, students, anybody of your acquaintance who might be interested, just let them know.
How are we doing on the charts? I haven't checked it in a while.
I check them every morning, but I don't think we've
Cunnel is waving
one
to
yet.
The window. He says we're at number 8. So we're holding a top 10 position. That's not bad.
Not bad.
Can we get a Christmas number 1? Who knows? Who
knows? Mistletoe and wine.
Okay. So for me, Peter Leonard.
And myself, Mark Tottenham.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you soon in the Fifth Court.